This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Anne Herningsbold is the Senior Conservator of Paintings at the National Gallery of Art in Washington and joins us on the program this morning. Hello, Anne.
Hi, how are you?
And firstly, when I was doing some reading on Degas, it said that he's an impressionist, a French impressionist, but that he didn't particularly like being called an impressionist.
Right. I think he just didn't want to be categorized and put in a box. And specifically, one of the things that he didn't want is to be associated with a group that were famous for working out of doors. Degas did not like working out of doors. And I think that was one good example of why he didn't like that categorization.
Why was he then categorized as an impressionist then?
Well, partly he did exhibit with them. They were among his friends. He was doing a lot of the same things that they were doing, very experimental in the way they handled paints. But I think he just didn't want to be grouped. I think he liked the fact that he wanted to be his own person, do his own thing, and occasionally work with them, but not be exclusively part of their crowd.
He originally, because he wanted to be a history painter, a painter of history. Can you firstly explain that to us and why he found that so interesting?
Well, I think it's the tradition he came from. He admired the old masters. He admired the way they painted. He admired their subject matter. And he wanted really to be like them at the very beginning. That's who he was looking at. And there was something very important about history painting. I mean, any traditional artist in France was expected to do that kind of painting. Those were the paintings that were accepted into the official salon. And I think that's why he did it at first, and then he slowly broke away from it. But it certainly is where he started. Those were his roots.
We need to, because I don't know that what is considered to be historical painting. It's obviously painting of history. But is it particular points in time in history or particular types of painting in history?
Well, I think a lot of his pictures show classical stories. They're the story of the Spartan women, story of Alexander and Bucephalus. These were the kinds of paintings that go back in time, and that really to him was what history painting was all about, and that is really what was accepted as sort of every artist in France was supposed to be focusing on that at least at some point in their career and as part of their oeuvre.
Was there for his family, was there were they happy that he decided to become an artist, or was there, like many other people who later became artists, there was a different career path that their family or his family wanted him to take?
Well, his father was a banker, and I think he probably would have been very happy if his son had become a banker. And for a very brief period, Degas did go to law school and thought of entering law, but that is obviously not where he went. I have to say, though, even though I think his father may not have chosen this career for his son, he did encourage him. It was with his father that he was first introduced to art. The family collected paintings. I mean, they had them in their house. And he wasn't discouraged. And I think once his family realized that this was his passion and what he wanted to do, they supported him.
And when you say supported him, they financially supported him and he went to art school?
They did financially support him at the very beginning. He actually didn't really go to art school for very long. He entered the École des Beaux-Arts, which was really the only path an artist had in the mid-19th century. And he only stayed there for a few months. But then what he did was I wouldn't say he was self-trained, but he sort of followed the same path that a student at the École would have followed. He would copy from the old masters. He would draw. He would sketch from sculptures. So it was a very, very classical, very academic background, but his family was supporting him while he was doing this.
And was he recognized for his ability early in life?
Yes, he was. I think people recognized very early that he had this skill. He was an incredible draftsman, something he continued his whole life. And he was accepted as a fine artist. I don't think anybody quite recognized what direction he would go, but he was encouraged by other artists. He was encouraged by the teachers that he was working with sort of independently, and I think he felt that he was moving in the right direction.
Did he spend a lot of time outside of France?
He went to Italy, where he actually had family, and he painted there, and mostly portraits of family members. But he also, you know, would copy things in museums in Italy, as he had already done in France. And then what we always find remarkable is he actually visited the United States as well. He had family in New Orleans. His mother came from New Orleans. And so he was there, I think it was 1872. And again, most of his paintings in New Orleans are family members again.
At that time, when he's painting family members, what else was he painting? Because I presume that the paintings that he did of ballet dancers came later in his career. We've
right.
talked a little bit about the historical paintings. What other things was he painting?
Well, I mean, certainly when he was in Italy and when he was in New Orleans, it really was, not exclusively, but for the most part, family members. He's not an artist who did a lot of landscapes. He did them later in his life. And the, as you said, the ballet dancers and the horse racing pictures come later. His portraits were very important to him, and that is really what he was doing. I mean, especially if you have family, you always have, you know, a source right there.
That isn't necessarily going to make you a living, though, doing portraits, especially of family.
No, but I don't think he was worried too much about making a living. I mean, it was only the only... at that point, early in his career, he was still being supported by the family, and he had family money. What was then, at one point, his father lost money, and that's really when Degas recognized that he better start painting things that could sell, and that's when he started these, you know, very much more finished ballet scenes, much more finished horse racing scenes, and those he could sell. He also started doing in the 70s. He did a series of fans, which he painted, and those were exclusively done because he knew that those could sell. So there was a period in his life when he didn't have to sell, and which was early on, and then later, in between, he was actually very cognizant of the market and painting things that he knew would find. You know, some buyers.
It was early in the, because he wrote one of the paintings, and I think it's an amazing looking painting, is the Cotton Office, which was done in New mm-hmm. Orleans.
Yeah.
Was that recognized as a great painting and still is?
It certainly is today.
Yeah.
It was recognized as a great painting. It was one of the first paintings that was bought by a museum. It may have been the first painting. The museum in Pau in France, where it still is, purchased it, I think it was 1878, and I think it was bought by subscription. I'm not entirely sure about that, but it was really interesting that it was painted not necessarily for sale, but it's a very finished painting. It's very tight, and again, it is actually a family portrait, although it's in a... in a setting that makes it look like an interior, but many of the figures in the painting are actually family members. His brothers are there, and it is the cotton market that was owned by the family.
And the series of paintings that he's done on horse racing as well as ballet are one of the ones that are probably he's most recognized for. Firstly, why horse racing?
He personally was interested in horse races. He went to the races. Whether he actually bet on the races, I don't know. But it was also a place that people would gather. People of his social milieu would go to the races. But I also think he was intrigued by the beauty of it, by the beauty of the horses, by the bright colors of the jockeys' silks, by the sort of the... Now, this is where he was painting outside. I think he found that interesting, or he was sketching outside. I mean, I think he found it interesting to have these sort of close-up details of figures, and yet there was this distance of the background. And it never bored him. I mean, he was doing horse racing pictures for a very, very long time. I think it was also he recognized the speed and the quality of light. All of those things, which actually are associated with the Impressionists, and he didn't want to be called an Impressionist, were something that appealed to him very much.
Was it also that sense of movement? Because it's something that you find with the ballet dancers as well, that his ability to, I don't know what the right words are, but you can feel the movement in the pieces.
Absolutely. I mean, he was very interested in movement. He was interested in what could be done with photography, for example, and how that related to movement. But the horses clearly were moving very, very quickly. The ballerinas were moving on stage, and yet a lot of his pictures were about the ballerinas resting. They were about the horses standing still. Some of the horses, of course, are leaping or vaulting, whatever, but it was also about capturing the moment, which again is what Impression is about. He was just doing it in his own way.
When, because we were both with the ballerinas and also with the horses and that idea of movement, was there also something important in the colors that he used when he portrayed those?
Well, I mean, I don't think he was, I think his colors were very, very bright, very intense in the horse racing pictures. But those actually were the colors of the jockey silks, and some of them were very dramatic. I mean, there's one picture in the exhibition where the jockey has a polka dot shirt, and I think that intrigued him. But you could get this juxtaposition of bright colors, and you get the juxtaposition of complementary colors, which was something that was very important to him. You'd have red next to green. You'd have orange next to blue. And, of course, that creates a vibration and intensifies the image. The ballerinas tended to be softer tones because their costumes tended very often to be pinks and greens. But again, those are the complementary colors that he's using very, very carefully to get the intensity and get the drama of it.
He's not recognized as much for his sculptures, although there are very important ones in the work that he's done. Why did he choose to sculpt? Was there something that he could do with sculpture, or he could get a feeling with sculpture that he couldn't do in paintings?
Well, we think that one of the first sculptures he did was actually a horse that he sculpted to help him with a painting. He was painting the picture from Brooklyn of Mademoiselle Fiocre, and there's a horse in the background. This is on stage. Then the horse was on the stage, and he had trouble because there was an angle. So the story is he actually sculpted this horse so he could work the image of it into his painting. But then I think he became intrigued with sculpture. There's also some discussion, and he wrote this in a letter to his dealer, Vollard, that he started sculpting because his eyesight was going. But in fact, he was sculpting before that. I think he liked the tactile quality. He liked building something. He's an artist who's fascinated with process. And sculpture is all about process in the same way that printmaking is. And so he was just taken with sculpture. And I think it started as sort of a tool, and then it developed into something much, much more than that.
Earlier you mentioned photography. Was he also interested in photography?
Yes, he was. He did some of his own photography later in life, but he also had many of his works photographed. And he actually, in fact, used photographs, some of these very early, I wouldn't call them color photographs, but they're photographs that have color in them, which he used to as a source for some of his paintings. We have a picture at the National Gallery of ballerinas, a very large painting with these greens and oranges, I mean, almost really garish colors, which we know come from a photograph he had of ballerinas. So he's using them in a number of ways, and he was a friend of early photographers. He was very aware. Again, it was about process. He knew that this was something new and experimental. In his own painting and printmaking, he was always using materials that were unconventional or using conventional materials in unusual ways. So this was not really surprising when you come to think of it, because he had been using new materials and new techniques for a long time.
Now, how did critics see him? As I was doing the reading, it said here that one of the sculptures, in fact, called The Little Dancer of 14 Years, sort of split the art world, and there were people that said it was ugly and other people said it was beautiful. Did he do that very much within the art world?
I think, yes. I mean, there were always some people who thought his work was very appealing, and there were some who thought that it wasn't. There were also many people who were critical of him for leaving things unfinished, and people who thought that there was a quality to his work that wasn't sort of detailed enough. But I think that for the most part, he was certainly, towards the end of his life, was considered a great master. I think he was appreciated by many, many artists. He was also sort of a grumpy, curmudgeonly person. So I think that there were some people who were just sort of fed up with him as a person, even more so than as an artist. And so he did run into some problems there.
My guest this morning is Anne Herningswald, who's a senior conservator of painting at the National Gallery of Art at Washington, D.C. And I'm not sure if it's common amongst artists, but he liked to collect work as well. He was quite a collector and appreciator of other people's work.
Yes. He had a remarkable collection. He particularly admired artists like Ingres and Delacroix. And he had very, very fine paintings by them in his collection. But he also collected Van Gogh and Mary Cassatt and Pizarro and Gauguin and, his own contemporaries. I think his intention was to open a museum at one point, and then that didn't really come to be. So most of these paintings were found in his studio at the end of his life, along with hundreds of his own pictures that he left in his studio, perhaps because he wasn't ever quite finished with them.
And is that common amongst great artists to collect other artists' work?
I think quite a number of artists collect other people's works. They collect the art that they admire. They collect the art of the artists they admire. And I don't think any artist I can think of had a collection like Degas did. But he really, he was different in so many ways. And I think it was sort of something historic, too. I mean, you know, people would have collections. And this is what also sets him apart from other late 19th century artists, that he saw that part of his legacy, part of something he could hold on to. But he also, you have to remember, he started as an artist who was always looking at the old masters and always looking at other works of art, and that's what inspired him. And so I think he wanted to be surrounded by it. But remarkably, he also wanted to be inspired and surrounded by the works of his contemporaries.
Dave joins us. Hello, Dave.
How you going, Trev?
Good, Dave.
That's the way. Years ago, they had a Degas exhibition at the National Gallery in Canberra. I took my parents along to that, and it was, I really, really enjoyed it. What I thought, I'm no art critic or anything, but one of the things that appealed to me with his work was he was brilliant like the Masters in that he could paint the light so well and highlight and draw your eye, and then he could soften the edges and it nearly became abstract in, you know, some of that ballerina stuff, and that was left something for your imagination, or whether the paintings weren't finished deliberately for that, I don't know. But there was some, he was a brilliant artist, really brilliant at painting light, I thought.
Yeah, Dave, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'm no art critic either, and I don't necessarily go and see a lot of artwork. But, and for many people who don't necessarily follow art or understand art in inverted commas, as people like yourself would, he's appreciated by the masses. And what do you think that is? Why?
Well, I think partly because of the subject matter. People, a lot of people like pictures of ballet dancers. They like pictures of horses. But I think he also uses color in a remarkable way, and he captures light, and he captures, as you said, speed and movement. And his portraits also really get to the essence of the sitter, and people find that appealing. There's also a lot of detail sometimes you can, you know, overhear people in an exhibition. They're just intrigued. They can stand in front of it, and they will be interested in all the details involved. So I think there are a lot of things about him. He's also not all that, well, he can be very complicated to understand. For us, he is. But I think you can also appreciate Degas on many, many levels, and he's a very approachable artist.
Margaret, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to say I'm 89 years old, and when I was about 10 or 12, I was into ballet, and my father bought a beautiful print for me of the ballet girls in the school room. One is sitting on a seat, and I've just loved that print for years and years.
Hmm.
And one day I took it and had it redone, and when I went back to pick it up in the art shop, they had them, as they did them, they put them on the floor till the people came in to collect them. And they said everyone had come in and just admired that print so much. And my daughter doesn't think much of all my what I have, but I love it. And I just wondered if it was worth anything these days.
I don't know about prints. Are prints worth anything, Anne?
Prints are worth a great deal, especially Degas' prints, because he was such an extraordinarily experimental printmaker. You know, of course, it depends on, you know, quality and how many states there are and, you know, what the condition of the print is. But, I mean, Degas is a printmaker. He is truly remarkable. So he's not just a painter by any means. This is one of the interesting things about Degas. He was a master at painting, at printmaking, at sculpture. He, in some ways, could do almost anything. And what I love is that from each one of these things, he clearly learns something else, and then it moves from one media to the next.
What was his private life like? Was he one of the artists that liked to socialize, that was with the aristocracy and with all the right people, or was he a very quiet person?
Well, a little of both. He would socialize with those people he wanted to socialize with. He also lived a very long life. He died when he was 83. And, you know, in his prime of life, I think he got out much more. The last, at the end of his life, there are stories of him really not being able to get out. His eyesight was bad. He didn't walk well. But he certainly would socialize with his own circle. I mean, he comes from the equivalent of the upper middle class then. And he had certain friends he was very close to. I mean, he was particularly close for a period, for example, with the American artist Mary Cassatt, who lived in Paris. They got along very well. There were other people who he criticized. He could be rude to people. He had no problem ending friendships with certain people, and yet with others, he was very devoted. And so he had his own way of doing things, and he was not unfriendly, but he was going to select who he was going to be friends with.
You said he was like a grumpy old devil. Again, when I was doing the reading to do this interview, it said that he believed that artists should be alone, that they should have a solitary life.
Well, I mean, and he did to a certain extent. I mean, it wasn't like he was out partying every night. But he, you know, a lot of people make mention of the fact that he was never married, and he actually felt that marriage would have gotten in the way of, you know, of creating his artwork. But he, you know, he did live alone. I mean, it was he and his housekeeper, who we've seen images of. But I think that he did get out. It wasn't like he was always alone. There are stories of him with many other artists, with family members. He was devoted to members of his family, very protective of certain people in his family, and very, very supportive of some artists. So it wasn't that he didn't socialize. It wasn't that he had nobody in his life, but he was not... I don't think anybody would call him a bon vivant, but he was going to select who he wanted to be with. He was totally devoted to his artwork. I mean, that's where he was really committed, and that's where he spent his time. And it's reflected in the number of works of art that he created, works on paper, paintings, sculptures, what he produced, and his oeuvre is truly remarkable.
Can we talk a little bit about the fact that he was anti-Semitic and why?
You're sort of getting out of my league here. I mean, I think it all had to do with the Dreyfus case.
Can you just tell us what that is?
No, you can't. The problem is, I don't want to get it wrong.
Okay.
But it was a very, you know, it was a very important court case, and it really divided people. And when you were, and he came down, you know, came out of it looking very anti-Semitic, and he lost a lot of friends over it.
So that did divide the community, and he sat on one side of the community.
It definitely divided the community, and it divided the artistic community. And it was something that many people could not get over.
But he was quite conservative in his politics as well, though.
Yes, he was. He was very conservative. It was the background he came from. And... you know, I don't think that bothered him. He said, you know, let me be who I am, and if you want to judge me as an artist, judge me as an artist, but don't use my politics to identify who I am.
One of the great things about that is because we generally associate artists as not being conservative, that we think of them as being, I'm not saying necessarily left of politics, but being very open and open for change.
Well, I think that, I mean, I think in every generation you're going to find some artists who are politically active and politically aware, and where it affects their art or affects who they are as a person, and they're going to find some who have nothing to do with it. I don't think that Degas was necessarily politically active, but the whole Dreyfus case was something that sort of put him in the spotlight.
Well, you talked a little bit earlier about his eyesight. Was that an issue for him as far as painting was concerned, and did that come through in his art later?
Well, this is something we debate a lot. I mean, the first reference I can recall of him mentioning his eyesight is when he goes to New Orleans, and that's only 1872, and he complains that the light was so strong. Then we also, you know, as I mentioned, some people think that he started sculpting because his eyesight was going. And he mentioned to Vollard, his dealer, that sculpture is a blind man's form of art or something like that. And yet we now know that he didn't do sculpture because of, you know, didn't turn to it simply because his eyesight was failing. At the end of his life, though, there's no question that he had issues with eyesight. And some people also think that he turned to pastel because it was easier to deal with pastel than with oil paints. And he liked the very, very strong, bright colors and the handling of pastel sticks, which were rather different from working with paint. But then he does go back to paint later in his life and paints very differently. And I'm always reluctant to describe an artist's artwork at the end of their life or relate it to eye problems. This is something we have with Renoir and with Monet as well. He certainly had a different style of painting at the end of his life, but I don't want to necessarily say that it came from his eyesight. But there's no question that at the end of his life, he was not seeing as well. He was diagnosed with eye problems, and that is something that is you know, been confirmed historically.
And you're an art restorer. Have you worked on his work?
Yes, I've worked on several of his paintings. I'm working on one right now, which is probably the most difficult picture I've ever worked on. And, you know, I admire him enormously as an artist because he's interested in process, which is something that painting conservators are particularly drawn to. And I find, you know, working with an artist who reveals themselves, reveals the development of their painting in the pictures, what we can tell from the x-rays and infrared images, which expose what's underneath, is intriguing to me. And I like seeing how he puts something together, how it emerges. Some of our pictures, for example, we have one large racing picture where we know that it was started in the 1860s. Then he goes back to it in the 1880s. And then returns to it yet again in the 1890s, and sort of deciphering each of those layers and figuring out why he changes and what's happening and what his reason for making these additions or subtractions, because what happens, he's not just adding paint, he's also scraping paint away. Those are the things that I find fascinating and one of the reasons I particularly love working on Degas.
But if you're going to be restoring, because the type of paint and the consistency of paints would have changed incredibly through centuries, how do you mm-hmm. go about matching that?
Well, when we work on paintings and we're doing what we call in-painting, which is just adding a little paint where there's paint loss, whether a painting is from the 13th century or from the 20th century, we actually don't change our paint for that. I mean, I wouldn't use tempera paint for an early Italian picture and acrylic paint for a modern picture. What we're interested in is using materials that are stable so that they don't change in any way. The colors don't fade, the colors don't darken. But we also want things use materials that are reversible. So if somebody in the future has to remove our addition to a picture, they can do it with great ease. And with Degas, for example, if he's working in oil paint, I will not use oil paint for my little areas of in-painting. Or if he's using distemper, which is painted in glue, something he does, or an egg tempera, which is painted with egg, obviously, I won't use those materials. So I might know what he's using. We'll do scientific analysis to identify those materials. But when I do the in-painting, I will use usually synthetic materials because I know they're stable and I know they're reversible.
Because we think about art restoration as possibly being, as you're calling it, in-painting, which I presume is touching up. What are the other things that need to be done as far as restoration is concerned?
Well, one of the major things we do is removing discolored varnish. Many artists would put varnish on a painting. Degas did. At least we know that on his oil paintings he did. I doubt he did it on his paintings in egg tempera or in distemper or gouache. Because he wanted a matte surface there. But on a conventional oil painting, he would put on a varnish, which he would put on as a clear coating. But as those varnishes, which were natural resins, as they aged, they would yellow. That's simply what happens to those materials. So, of course, what will happen then is the yellow coating on the surface makes the areas of white turn yellow, makes the areas that are blue turn green, and it distorts the color relationships that the artist intended. It also sort of visually flattens out a painting because you're putting this unifying veil on top of it. And it also distorts the intended surface of the painting and the character of the application of paint. So it simply changes what the artist wanted. So we can very carefully remove the discolored varnish, because usually varnish is soluble in materials other than the paint layer.
Hmm.
We remove that, and we get back to what the artist intended, or closer to what the artist intended. And that's what we're trying to do in painting conservation, is make the paintings look as much as they did when they left the artist's easel. So we'll remove varnishes, we'll do in painting if there's a tiny loss. And then our real concern, which luckily we don't have to deal with too much here, is if paint is flaking or if a wooden panel is cracking, then those are issues that we would call structural issues, and we will, we would do consolidation.
And thank you very much for joining us. We might get you back on another occasion to talk about restoration.
Thank you. This is great fun.
This is Overnights on ABC Radio.